Thank you very much. I'd also like to thank Spiro and all the organizers for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to come here. So the title of the talk is up there. This is a talk on ADS-CFT. Probably some of you know quite familiar with this topic. Maybe the most of you are not, haven't seen it before. There will be further talks today and also tomorrow. In fact, some of the talks tomorrow are on the more physical aspects of this. Today's talk is going to be purely mathematical, but I just thought I'd say a few words about what this terminology is. ADS-CFT is a correspondence. It's also known as the Maldacena conjecture or gauge gravity duality. Things, sort of a lot of different words for it. ADS stands for anti de Sitter space. This is the Lorentzian analog of hyperbolic space. CFT stands for conformal field theory. And the basic sort of paradigm or perspective of what this is about is that it's a physical theory in which on the one side, the ADS side involves a metric. So metrics are, in terms of physics, are involve gravity. So one has gravitational theories on the ADS side, things like general relativity or string theory or things like this. This takes place on a manifold called the bulk manifold, but this manifold is not a closed manifold or compact manifold. It actually has boundary, and that's on the boundary is where the CFT, the conformal field theory, is taking place. And so on the boundary, when it does not there is no gravity, there's no metric per se, and the physical theories on the boundary are gauge theories, things like Yang-Mills theories. And so there's a correspondence or duality between these, and so this allows the physicists to try to understand theories involving gravity by passing to the boundary where there's no gravity. There's some simplifications going on. So hopefully you'll hear a lot more about this tomorrow. So again, this is going to be purely mathematical talk, but that describes sort of the setting for it. Okay, so here's the mathematical sort of background. So we're dealing with a compact manifold. Can everybody see that? Okay, is that focused enough? Is that focused well enough? Is it okay? Any complaints? Okay. So M is a compact manifold, connected, oriented. It has a boundary. The boundary may or may not be connected, and sort of distinguish where the boundary is. One uses a defining function. So rho, so it's like a coordinate function or a distance function from the boundary. So rho is a non-negative function. The zero set of rho is precisely the boundary of M, and the differential of rho is everywhere non-zero in the boundary. So think of it like a coordinate x or rho. Typical example would be typical example of the situation, you could take just a smooth bounded domain in Euclidean space and take rho to be the distance to the boundary. So that's the topological setting, topological data one has, and now we'll look at metrics. So conformally compact metrics, these were introduced by Penrose, I guess in the 60s or early 70s, in the context of general relativity, but they come up, they're the setting of the framework of this ADS setting. So you're not interested in metrics which are smooth up to the boundary. So you're not interested in metrics which make this manifold appear as a compact manifold with boundary. Instead, you're looking at metrics where the boundary is at infinity. So boundary is infinitely far away. So therefore, the metric is complete. Complete means it takes geodesics infinite time to, or infinite distance to actually reach the boundary of the manifold. But you can look for complete metrics on this manifold, which can be conformally compactified or conformally brought into finite distance. So a metric is conformally compact in the sense of Penrose if there is a defining function rho, such that if you change your metric g by rho, so essentially g is going to infinity as you go to the boundary, rho is going to zero as you go to the boundary, and so there's a balance of zero times infinity here, and this requirement is essentially that this balance then becomes finite and not infinity, not zero, it's some finite positive value. So g bar rho squared times rho should be a smooth Riemannian metric on the compactified manifold, so on M union as boundary. So this is a technical issue of how smooth you want this to be, CM alpha. The metric G itself does not induce any metric itself on the boundary, but when you compactify it like this, so now you do, G bar is a smooth metric on a manifold with boundary, so you can now take the induced metric on the boundary. That's this gamma here. Any compact manifold with boundary has lots and lots of conformally compact metrics on it. They're very, very easy to construct. The most important example is the Poincaré. So I'll be dealing here. One could do all of this in various kinds of signatures, Riemannian signature, Lorentzian signatures, or other kinds of signatures even. All the talk will be in the case of Riemannian metrics. The Lorentzian case, there's analogs or the similarities, but we won't be getting into that. So in the Riemannian setting, ADS corresponds to hyperbolic, so the Poincaré metric and the hyperbolic metric is sort of the canonical starting example. So I've written down sort of two forms of that metric, here and here. Here's the first one is the hyperbolic metric in polar coordinates, and the second one is the usual expression of the hyperbolic metric as being conformal to the Euclidean metric on the unit ball. So the R's there, it's bad notation, I guess. The two R's here and here are quite different objects. But anyway, in the first case, so the example on the left, you can define rho to be that expression, 2 e to the minus R. And when you then pass to g bar, which is rho squared times g, just work it out, you get this formula here. So this is a smooth metric on the unit ball. It's not flat, but it's a nice smooth metric. If instead you have g is the same metric, but instead if you choose a slightly different defining function, rho given by this expression, so this rho is just the inverse or the inverse square root of this factor up here. So if you multiply g by that rho square, the 4 over 1 minus r squared square just cancels, and g bar is then just the Euclidean metric. So these g bars here are different conformal compactifications of the intrinsic or the metric of interest g itself. So the hyperbolic metric, the complete metric g, is the one of interest, but you can try to work with an unphysical or somewhat of a non-geometric metric, which is somewhat simpler by compactifying the physical metric of interest, G. But there's various ways of doing this, and so there's various choices involved. In this example, in both cases, the induced metric on the boundary, gamma, is just the round metric on the sphere. So many of you are familiar with hyperbolic space having a sphere at infinity, so here this is sort of one representation of the sphere at infinity for hyperbolic geometry. Notice that Euclidean space with the flat metric is not conformally compact in this particular sense. Of course, you can sort of try to conformally compactify Euclidean space, but when you do that, you get a closed manifold. So the conformal compactation of Euclidean space is a one-point compactification, and so the structure you get is a closed manifold, namely a sphere, which is not a manifold with boundary. So that for Euclidean space, there is no boundary per se. So conformally compact metrics are naturally associated with negative curvature, not zero or positive curvature. It's an easy exercise, a little computation, to see that if a metric G is conformally compact, or say C2 conformally compact, then in fact the sectional, so K here denotes any sectional curvature of the metric G, so all the sectional curvatures of the metric G differ from a fixed constant mu by a term of order O of rho squared. So all the sectional curvatures converge to a fixed constant mu, which is strictly negative as rho goes to zero. So as you're going to the boundary, as rho goes to zero, you're going to the boundary, and all the sectional curvatures are getting pinched or converging to a definite value. So you can scale then the metric G if you like. So this this mu here is minus 1, and so this gives you the this is telling you basically that conformally compact metrics also these metrics are becoming asymptotically hyperbolic in a natural sense. All the sectional curvatures are converted to minus 1. So one uses this terminology kind of interchangeably back and forth. So as I mentioned before, that there are lots and lots of defining functions. I didn't mention it before, perhaps, but there are, of course, lots and lots of defining functions on a compact manifold of boundary, given one defining function rho, and given any positive function f, you can just multiply them together to get another defining function rho tilde, and vice versa. All defining functions are related in this fashion. So if you have one compactification g bar here, you can get another compactification g tilde just by multiplying g bar by a positive function. So this is, of course, a conformal change of metrics. So the different compactifications of a given metric give you different compactifications which are all conformal to one another. Associated with the intrinsic structure of M and G, only the conformal class of the compactification and only the conformal class of the metric on the boundary are well defined or well determined from the structure MG that you have. Of particular importance is this conformal infinity, which is the conformal class of the boundary metric on the boundary. Okay. All right, that's sort of the background. What are the issues? Well, these issues were first raised by Pfefferman Graham in an important paper in the middle 80s. Related to their study of conformal invariance of Riemannian metrics. And then in the late 90s, Maldacena started this ADS-CFT correspondence in physics, and it's sort of grown like a wildfire in physics. It's very it's seen a great deal of activity in physics for more than a decade now. The ADS-CFT correspondence involves many, many different aspects of things, but both the Pfefferman Graham paper in particular and some aspects of ADS-CFT are asking one to understand and study issues related to conformally compact metrics, which are Einstein. So they satisfy the Einstein equation. The Einstein metrics are negatively curved or negative scalar curvature Einstein metrics for reasons we've already seen before. Conformally compact metrics require or favor negative curvature. So if one takes that as an issue one wants to study or understand, so then the natural basic mathematical questions are. The Einstein equation is a PDE, and one wants to understand, as with any PDE, existence and uniqueness questions. So, for example, global existence, given a topological data, so given a manifold of boundary, and given a conformal class on the boundary, which is representing conformal infinity, does there exist a conformally compact or asymptotically hyperbolic Einstein metric on that manifold, which has the prescribed given conformal infinity that you specified? So think of this as kind of a nonlinear Dirichlet problem at infinity. You want to specify the conformal class and fill it in, find a solution to the Einstein equations, which realizes that data at infinity. With existence, there is uniqueness. Given two asymptotic hyperbolic Einstein metrics or conformally compact Einstein metrics on a given manifold with boundary, or possibly with on two different manifolds which have the same common boundary. And if the two conformal infinities, gamma 1 and gamma 2, of those two metrics are the same, if the conformal infinities agree, do the corresponding Einstein metrics also agree? Namely, are the two Einstein metrics isometric to one another? And therefore also, in particular, the two manifolds, are they diffeomorphic to one another? there are many other, these are sort of the maybe the most fundamental questions, the most basic questions one wants to answer. There are many further issues beyond this. Boundary regularity is somewhat of a technical issue. I'll mention that maybe a little bit, but not too much here. The question per se is asking if you have, if the metric is conformally compact Einstein, and the conformal infinity has a certain degree of smoothness, say Cm alpha, does the solution inherit that same degree of smoothness as a boundary metric? All right. So these kinds of questions, at least the first two, will be sort of a guiding theme throughout the talk. These involve kind of global issues. One wants to understand the sort of the global behavior of Einstein metrics, but in doing so, you want to sort of look at both the behavior near the boundary and also far away from the boundary into the interior. These are kind of different regimes or different realms within the metric, and in particular, it's important to understand the behavior near infinity or the asymptotic behavior of these Einstein metrics. So that's what we'll look at first. So the asymptotic or the behavior near the boundary. For this kind of to do this, it's most convenient to look at what are called geodesic compactifications. So you have a given metric G, which is complete, so the boundary is near infinity, and you can look at defining functions T. So T is now replacing rho. So you want T to be the distance to the boundary with respect to G bar. So it's not hard to see these compactifications always exist. Given any conformally compact metric or conformally compact Einstein metric, you can always given a choice of given one compactification, one conformal compactification will give you a choice of a representative of conformal infinity, so you'll have an induced metric on the boundary. Given any such, you can change your compactification so that it's geodesic. So this is these are the for certain respects, these are the most natural or easy to compute with. The reason being, namely, is that for geodesic compactifications, one can use the Gauss lemma or Gaussian or geodesic coordinates. So the metric splits along geodesics. These are geodesics sort of normal to the boundary with respect to G bar. And so G bar splits as dt squared plus gt bar. And gt bar is a curve of metrics on the boundary. So here you're near the boundary. So you're writing the metric here, G bar, in a collar neighborhood of the boundary. So topologically, that's just I cross the boundary. And so T is running over this interval I. GT is just a metric on the boundary, which is changing in T. So you have a curve of metrics on the boundary. So when T equals 0, you're at the boundary. So G bar sub 0 is the boundary metric. And as you go from the boundary into the interior, GT is describing how the metric on the boundary is changing. So you have a one-parameter family of curves now on the boundary, so the kind of the natural thing to do, the kind of the obvious thing to do is to expand this curve in a Taylor series. And the Einstein equations are going to give you equations or information or relations on the coefficients of this Taylor series. So this is a series of, this is a Taylor series of symmetric bilinear forms, GT bar is a metric on the boundary depending upon T, so it's a symmetric bilinear form. So you're going to get a Taylor series of symmetric bilinear forms. So this is what Pfefferman and Graham did in their paper in the middle 80s, and what you get is what's called the Pfefferman Graham expansion. So it's quite surprising that the behavior, what happens depends upon whether the dimension is odd or even. I'm not sure where I said what n is. So n is the dimension of the boundary. So n here is the dimension of the boundary. The bulk manifold M has dimension n plus 1. Right. So if n is odd, you get a regular kind of Taylor series. So when t equals 0, you have the induced metric gamma. It turns out, it's not hard to see, it turns out that there's no first-order term. The first-order term is 0 in this geodesic computation. Then you pick up a second-order term. It turns out that this expansion, this series, is in even powers of t for a while, anyway. So you just have no t cubed to the t to the fourth term times g4 and so on. You keep on going to like that until you get to the n minus first, which is the last even power, and then you get to the t to the n, g to the n term, and then the series continues after that, a mixture of even and odd, even and odd powers of t. If n is even, the series, formal series, starts off the same way. However, it turns out that at order n here, something different happens in even dimensions. Namely, there's a term here which is which typically has to be there in order to get a consistent formal expansion to satisfy the equations. So this is called the Pfefferman-Graham obstruction tensor. It's the obstruction to having a formal power series solution. So if h happened to be 0, it would turn out that you'd actually get a regular power series like in the case n odd. The presence of this h here, presence of the h forces a log term here as a coefficient, and when h is non-zero, the series you get involves powers of t and log t. So it's not a power series, it's called a polyhomogeneous series, a series in powers of t and log t. This is also very important in physics. In physics, this is called the variation or the stress energy tensor of the conformal anomaly. So this is also of great physical interest. So it turns out, it's just a computation, that the Einstein, so this is in general, this you could do this quite generally. The Einstein equations, though, force or tell you that all the coefficients in your Taylor series or your formal series are determined by these two terms here, gamma and gn. So gamma is the metric on the boundary, and gn is its coefficient here. You should think of this as being like Dirichlet and Neumann data. So this, of course, corresponds to Dirichlet data. This is kind of exotic maybe for Neumann data. So Dirichlet plus Neumann is Cauchy data. So these are, one could call these pieces of data here the geometric Cauchy data for G bar or for G itself at the boundary. This picture is analogous to doing something somewhat simpler where you just take an Einstein metric on a bounded domain and do the same kind of thing on a bounded domain. Just look at the formal Taylor series for an Einstein metric coming from the boundary into the interior. There, do the same kind of series expansion. There, the basic geometric data will be the metric and the second fundamental form, and then all the higher. This appears at order 0. This appears at order 1. This is like Neumann, and then all the higher coefficients will be determined by these two. So this is somewhat analogous in a formal sense to the second fundamental form. Of course, there is no second fundamental form exactly here. It's 0. The constraint equations give you a bit more information that these two terms here are formally undetermined. So these are sort of free, in some sense, formally freely chosen quantities. You can satisfy the Einstein equations for arbitrary choices, independent choices of these two guys, more or less. You can solve them freely modulo the constraints. So the constraint equations for the Einstein metrics, these amount to the Gauss and Gauss-Godotti equations on the boundary, tell you that the divergence of this GN term and the trace of this GN term are, in fact, determined by gamma. I should also say that this H term, the Pfefferman-Graham obstruction tensor, is also determined by gamma. So the G2 term, the G4 term, all the terms, all the coefficients until you get to GN are determined by gamma. H is also determined by gamma. And then when GN appears, that's a free term again. Past that, all the terms are determined by GN and gamma. So this gives you a pretty good handle on what the metric looks like near infinity if you can understand gamma and GM. Okay. All right. So that's the asymptotic behavior. Let's go back now and look at the these global issues. So the global existence and uniqueness questions. So now we're going away from the boundary back in sort of the manifold as a whole. So here's the setting. So fix any manifold of boundary. There may be conformally compact Einstein metrics on that manifold, maybe not, who knows. But regardless of whether there are or not, you could just consider the space of such things. So consider the space of all conformally compact or asymptotic hyperbolic Einstein metrics on that manifold, which have CM alpha conformal compactifications. So that's some space. It may be empty. It may not be. It's there. So this is the space of metrics. Well, as usual in geometry, it's metric itself isn't. In geometry, one doesn't distinguish between metrics which are isometric to one another, and the diffeomorphism group is the group which describes when metrics are isometric or not. So the diffeomorphism group acts on this space. You could choose various different kinds of diffeomorphism groups on manifolds of boundary, but for various reasons, the most natural choice is the diffeomorphisms which fix the boundary, which are the identity on the boundary. So that's this D1 here. And so now you form the quotient, the moduli space of these Einstein metrics as a quotient by a diffeomorphism group. That's the ADS side of things, the Einstein metrics in the interior, complete metrics. On the boundary, you have this conformal infinity, so you can just look at the space of conformal classes. These are now pointwise conformal classes. It's pointwise because the diffeomorphisms are being fixed on the boundary. So just pointwise conformal classes of smooth metrics on the boundary. And so now, as from what we've described before, you can see that the natural map, the boundary map, which will take a conformally compact Einstein metric and which will map it to its Dirichlet data at infinity, namely its conformal class, so its conformal infinity. And so the two questions that were on a previous slide, namely the global existence question, is just the question whether this map here, pi, is onto or not, whether it's surjective, and uniqueness is just the question of whether this map here is one-to-one. So that's the setting we're going to work in. So one wants to sort of do analysis on this map pi and understand as much as one can about it. All right. So the starting point. So the space C is of course space of conformal classes. That's a pretty explicit thing. One knows that quite detailed what that is. What about the space E? So the first result is sort of a structure theorem about sort of a soft structure theorem about the structure of the space E. Let's see. Suppose we start off in dimension 4. So n is 3. The ambient dimension n plus 1 is 4. And make also this topological condition that pi 1 of m relative to its boundary is 0. This is a technical topological assumption. It's not such a big deal, really, but nevertheless, let's assume it. Then you have the following dichotomy. Either the moduli space is empty, there aren't any Einstein metrics, or if it's not empty, then it's a smooth, infinite-dimensional Banach manifold. So it has a nice global structure. Moreover, this Dirichlet boundary map, which associates to the Einstein metric its conformal infinity, it's a smooth map. It's Fredholm of index 0. Index here being the Fredholm index, so that's dimension of the kernel of the linearization of pi. Pi is the boundary map. Dimension of the kernel of linearization of pi minus the dimension of the co-kernel. So this is telling you that if you now look at the image, so here's your moduli space, you can look at its image over here. We'd sort of like to know how big the image is. So you could just take this space here and look how it sits inside here. So it sits at worst, in the worst situation, if it's not empty, it sits as some kind of variety of finite codimension in the space of conformal classes. I'm going to avoid a good number of technicalities here in this talk. I won't talk about what these modifications are, but in an essential sense, this result also holds in all dimensions. There's issues of boundary regularity, which could be made more precise here, but I don't want to get into that here. So this is saying that in particular, this moduli space is a manifold, so any tangent vector, any infinitesimal Einstein deformation can actually be integrated to a curve of Einstein deformations. The moduli space is integrable or unobstructed. This is well known to be false for compact manifolds. So there's famous examples of Koizo, which say that there are situations where the moduli space for Einstein metrics on compact manifolds is in fact obstructed. What I also find surprising is that in the bounded domain case, so if you're dealing with not the conformally compact setting where the boundary is at infinity, but if you're dealing with Einstein metrics which are smooth up to a boundary and the boundary is therefore at finite distance, you can do exactly the same setup here, same framework. You can certainly set up the situation here and ask whether this theorem is true. Well, the manifold part of the theorem is true, so the moduli space in this case is also a manifold. However, this map here is not Fredholm. This is not an elliptic boundary value problem. You have infinite dimensional kernel and co-kernel. So it's really the conformally compact situation which is giving you these good properties here. Things are much worse in the bounded domain case, which is kind of strange. This result was a generalization of earlier work that was done by Graham and Lee in the early 90s, followed up with a generalization by Descartes about 10-11 years ago. They proved a local result, namely that this boundary map pi is a local diffeomorphism. Pi's local diffeomorphism, and therefore, particularly, you have a manifold structure near the metrics where the kernel of the linearization is zero. So this is a proof by the inverse function theorem. The generalization, the general case, you replace the inverse. Place the proof by the inverse function theorem by using the implicit function theorem. There's also some boundary regularity issues. You can read this if you like, but you're going to skip it. It's not that important for us here. The proof also uses the unique continuation theorem, which is rather important. So I want to explain what that unique continuation theorem is. So this was proved by myself and with Mark Herzlich, and also independently by Descartes. So says the following. So remember from an earlier slide, one has this geometric Cauchy data, namely the metric gamma, which is like Dirichlet, and this other undetermined term Gn here, which is like Neumann. So the nth term in the Pfefferman-Graham expansion. So these two terms, gamma and gn, as I said, as it came up before, those two terms determine the full formal expansion of the Einstein metric as a formal Taylor series or a formal polyhomogeneous series. So it sort of determines the infinite order jet of the Einstein metric near infinity. Unique continuation issues are issues in PDEs whether if you have sort of formal agreement of the Cauchy data or the infinite jet of two solutions of a PDE, say at a boundary, whether the solutions are in fact then exactly the same in the interior. Lots of different, lots of continuation theorems for PDEs and PDEs, also geometric PDEs. So in this setting here, this theorem says that locally, if you have a conformally compact Einstein metric, is uniquely determined up to isometry by its geometric quotient data, these two terms here. And it's true globally if you have this pi 1 condition. This theorem was took a long time to prove. This is actually used to prove the manifold theorem. Bicard's result is actually requires certain hypotheses which are too strong to be useful to apply, say, to the manifold theorem. So one needs, I haven't listed here the technical hypotheses one needs, but so Bicard's version of this actually can't be used to apply to the manifold theorem. The important issue is this, both proofs essentially in some sense reduced to a classical unique continuation theorem of Calderon. In order to get that reduction, to place it in the usual PDE context, one has to find a good gauge. Bicard uses the geodesic gauge that we talked about before. Geodesic gauge is very nice computationally, but it has bad regularity properties. And regularity properties are important here. And it turns out, for regularity properties, one wants a gauge which is both elliptic and preserves the quotient data. There's quite a tension between those two requirements here, and it's not easy or obvious how to find a gauge which will work. After trying for quite a long time, there's a gauge that was used or developed in general relativity by Lars Anderson and Vince Moncrief. So-called prescribed mean curvature foliation gauge. So you prescribe, you have the boundary here and you come into the interior with leaves, and you have these leaves with prescribed mean curvature coming in from the boundary. On the boundary itself, or on these leaves, you use harmonic coordinates. So it's a mixture of prescribed mean curvature and harmonic coordinate gauge. So this happens to have both of these properties. No, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Selection of sensors is determined by gamma, in fact, so it doesn't really come in. Another result, which is also both conceptually and also technically important, we'll be using it later, is this an isometry extension theorem, which says that if you have a conformally compact Einstein metric, and again, make this topological condition on pi 1, then it's saying that basically symmetries of the boundary, symmetries of the conformal infinity, must always extend to symmetries of any bulk solution, any Einstein metric in the interior. So if you have a conformal Killing field on the boundary, that extends to an exact Killing field in the interior. So, for example, if the boundary is homogeneous, if boundary of M gamma has a great deal of symmetry, if it's even homogeneous, then all that degree of symmetry in the boundary will be inherited by, in fact, any solution, any global bulk solution in the interior. So, why do you need the pi 1 condition? Pardon?
Why do you need the pi 1 condition?
I'll answer that in a second. So, the main idea to prove this is to show that this is what you're given, basically. You're given a Killing field on the boundary, so the vector field X preserves the metric gamma, or the conformal class of gamma. That's what this is saying. From this, you want to prove that, in fact, this Killing field X preserves the GN term. Again, the two crucial terms in the expansion are gamma and GN. So if you can prove this, then you can apply the unique continuation theorem as described over here. So the unique continuation theorem is a local theorem. So it says that you have uniqueness sort of locally near the boundary, but if you now want to just analytically continue globally everywhere, you need this pi 1 condition. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So let's assume it's a killing field. Okay? You can generalize this. So here it's written as a killing field. The difference in killing fields and conformal killing fields is a minor issue. I've just neglected it here. This result is also true in the bounded domain case. In fact, the result was first proved in the bounded domain case and then extended to the conformally compact case afterwards. It's true in the bounded domain case, provided one adds this extra assumption here, which is necessary. If you drop this assumption, the assumption is dropped in the bounded domain case, the result is false. This whole issue is related to very classical old issues in the classical differential geometry of surfaces in R3. So this issue of isometry extension is related to the rigidity of, for instance, isometric embeddings in R3. And this is still a completely open question, very interesting and intriguing question, I find, but very, very little is known about this seemingly very simple question. The proof, I'm not saying anything about proofs here, but the proof relies on a careful, various things, but the basic idea, the starting point is a careful study of the second variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action. Given by this, R here is a scalar curvature. This result is also false for Lorentz metrics. So when you really use the Riemannian signature here, the Kerr solution is a counterexample for Lorentz metrics, the ADS Kerr solution. Okay. All right. So we have the global manifold theorem. So the technical unique continuation theorem that's used to prove the manifold theorem, the sort of extension of isometries. Let's return now to these questions of existence and uniqueness. So do you have uniqueness? Let's look at the uniqueness question first. Before the Pfefferman-Graham paper in 82, there was a beautiful paper of Hawking and Page where they discussed what's going on with the so-called ADS Schwarzschild metric. This is a curve of metrics, a family of metrics. So topologically, the manifold is just R2 cross S2. So simple topology. The boundary, therefore, is just S1 cross S2. This also holds in all dimensions. You do the same thing in all dimensions, but we'll stick with dimension 4 for simplicity. So you have a parameter M, positive parameter M, which is called a mass. And the metric has this very simple explicit form. 1 over F, I don't know why I put a minus there. Forget the minus sign in front of the 1 over F. Just ignore it. Shouldn't be there. 1 over F dr squared plus F d theta squared. So dr squared, d theta squared, those are polar coordinates for an R2. So that's the first R2 factor. Then you have plus R squared times the metric on the sphere, so that's the S2 factor. F is given to you explicitly by that simple formula. R is not running from 0 to infinity, it's running from R plus to infinity, where R plus is the largest root of this cute polynomial. So to make this little computation shows that to make this metric smooth, this metric looks like it might be singular at R plus. F at R plus is 0, so the coefficient f of r plus is 0, so you have a 0 in front of the theta squares and an infinity in front of the dr squares. It looks like it might be singular. That's just an apparent singularity or removable singularity, provided you require theta to run in theta to run over an angular interval of this length. So theta runs from 0 to this number, not 0 to 2 pi. So when you do that, you have a nice globally smooth metric on R2 cross S2. It's conformally compact, it's Einstein, and you can look at the behavior of its conformal infinity. When you look at its conformal infinity, you just ignore this R piece here. R is like the distance to conformal infinity, so you just drop that. The induced metric of conformal infinity is just this part, these two parts here, and you just divide by the R squared. You just divide by the R squared, and you see that you're getting at conformal infinity just a product metric like this. where the circle here has a length not 2 pi, but the length of the circle is given by this number here, by this function of r plus. R plus is a function of the mass, so as the m varies, m appears in the s there, so as m varies, r plus varies, you can now just plot this function and see what it looks like, and it looks like this. And when you see that, you see then right away that uniqueness fails. Because so these curve metrics, when m is changing, the metrics are isometrically distinct. So choosing different m's for the Schwarzschild metrics gives you resulting distinct isometry classes of metrics. So if you choose two different m's here, they can have the same value of L. And therefore, they have the same conformal infinity. So two different metrics in the interior, two different Schwarzschild metrics in the interior have the same conformal infinity. So in fact, along this curve of Schwarzschild metrics, pi is 2 to 1. It's a 2 to 1 fold map. In terms of this picture we had before, this boundary map pi, here you are sort of in the moduli space of these Einstein metrics. Here you are, the conformal infinities, the conformal classes. Here's the Schwarzschild curve, and this projection pi is just mapping this curve here to something like this. You have a critical point here, and now you start reversing direction. So uniqueness fails in general already. In fact, you can use the same, once you understand the Schwarzschild metric like this, surjectivity also fails. So, in fact, by the isometry extension theorem, which we mentioned before, this conformal infinity has a large symmetry group. It's homogeneous. So any Einstein filling with this boundary would also have to have this degree of symmetry, and you can then easily see that the only infillings with this conformal infinity are Schwarzschild metrics, regardless of what L is. Take L larger than this value here. If you had an Einstein filling with this symmetry, it would have to be Schwarzschild, but there aren't any Schwarzschild metrics with L larger than this number here. So the isometry extension theorem tells you that pi can't be onto in this setting, so you don't have global existence always. Can the mass be zero? I'm just trying to think. If it is zero, you'd pick up the hyperbolic metric, but I think there's some collapse going on. So, not with these conformal infinities. This is not. Usual positive mass theorems require a sphere, a really round sphere at infinity. This is not the round sphere at infinity, right? No, none of these metrics are hyperbolic. In fact, even when m goes to zero, what? Zero. Right. R plus is going to zero. Right, so the circle is collapsing. Right, the circle, as m goes to zero, the circle is collapsing. So there's no obvious limit. You could rescale or do some, but. All right, so both existence and uniqueness fail. Things get even worse. In fact, there are situations where pi is not even finite to one. There are other black, the ADS Schwarzschild metric is a so-called spherical black hole metric. There are other kinds of black hole metrics, namely ADS toral black hole metrics. Again, you can write them down explicitly. This is similar formulas to this one here. And if you look at these, you can actually have infinitely many distinct metrics, say on T2 cross R2, or R2 cross T2, so you just replace the sphere by a torus, you have infinitely many solutions which have the same conformal infinity. The conformal infinity is just a fixed, arbitrary but fixed flat metric on T3. So things are looking kind of bad. Uniqueness fails. Global existence both fail. This boundary map can be infinite to one in some situations. All right, so let's. Is there any progress that one can make? Somehow I've lost it, but anyway. So things can be cured somewhat or made better by introducing a condition, the conformal class in the boundary. So consider instead of arbitrary conformal infinities, consider C0, which is the space of conformal classes, which have representatives of non-negative scalar curvature, but not flat. So this rules out, for instance, the metrics on the three torus that we were on the previous slide. So that's now you're restricting your conformal infinities. This is a subset. Think of it as an open subset. So maybe think strictly positive if you like. Think of it as an open subset of the target space of the space of conformal classes. And now look at the inverse image of that in the space of Einstein metrics. So now you're not looking at all possible Einstein metrics, but just Einstein metrics which have whose conformal infinities fall on this class. There were certain physical arguments suggested by Witten in the early days of ADS-CFT, which suggest, I don't really understand these arguments well, but suggest that existence may not hold or may fail when you're outside this realm of positive conformal infinities. Corresponding CFT becomes unstable when scalar curvature becomes negative. This motivated an interesting result of Witten and Yao shortly thereafter, who proved this topological result that if you have an Einstein metric whose conformal affinity is positive, then necessarily the boundary must be connected. And in fact, moreover, you have this topological conclusion. So you can't have a boundary here and another boundary over here, or three boundaries or things like this. In fact, one can, by a different argument, a very elementary argument, one can prove something somewhat more quantitative or stronger, that if the scalar curvature, if you have a metric on the boundary, which the scalar curvature is strictly positive, this is not a conformal condition, but if you have a representative class with strictly positive scalar curvature, then the geodesic compactification associated with that metric has to have a definite bound on its width. So here's one infinity, you can only go a definite amount away from that in terms of the geodesic compactification. So there couldn't possibly be other boundaries infinitely far away from this one. So in particular, there could only be one boundary. So this is saying that you can't go very far in away from one fixed boundary. Yeah, you're right. That should be an n there and not an n minus one. Thank you. No, I'm not. This teacher's not working anymore. Oh well. All right. Here's the main result. Oh, a reverse. Okay. Oh. All right. So the main theorem is now over there. This is now strictly four-dimensional, so your bulk dimension is four, a boundary is three-dimensional, and suppose now, in addition to that pi 1 hypothesis, that one has H2 of the boundary surjects onto H2 of the manifold. Then this boundary map pi 0, so you take the boundary map restricted to this open set here, That map is proper, so the proper Fredholm map of index 0. Whenever you have a proper Fredholm map, there's a natural degree associated with them, a Smale degree, or they're more, Smale degree is Z2 valued. There are enhanced degrees which are Z valued. So in this case, you can actually find a Z valued degree by a formula like this. I don't want to get into the technicalities here. But as with all degrees, the degree of the map is non-zero, then necessarily that map is surjective. So this result, many years ago, I claimed this result and wrote proofs. It's actually taken a long time for this to actually all the details to be worked out, but it is has all been done by now. So I'm not going to go into details of how this is proved. It's a long process, but some of the highlights are this properness is a compactness statement or an a priori estimate. One has to show that the control of the conformal infinity implies control of the solutions, any a priori, any possible solutions you may have in the interior. The hypothesis on H2 rules out overfold generations. It's possible one could go further and just deal with these overfold generations as part of the general theory, and so this hypothesis may not be so necessary. However, this hypothesis is really crucial. So the hypothesis that you're in the positive conformal class rules out cusp formations, so rules out formations of other ends. So you have a sequence of metrics on the boundary. The metrics in the interior could gradually develop new ends or new asymptotic structures away from this controlled asymptotic structure. And this estimate here is saying that you can't have any kind of formation of new ends or new kinds of asymptotic behaviors by this estimate here. Finally, then, so what can then do with this? So one can now start. So we're now going to actually compute the degree using this isometry extension theorem. This theorem up here is again just a reminder, a restatement of this isometry extension theorem, which we talked about before. And so now you can build sort of a table. The most natural thing to look at, starting point, is this manifold here. So here, just looking at the four ball with the boundary three metric. So the moduli space may be empty, or if it's not empty, it's this infinite dimensional Banach manifold. Well, of course, on this space here, there is a seed metric, there is a Poincaré metric. So the moduli space is not empty. So it is infinite dimensional space, and you can use this isometry extension theorem to compute the degree, and the degree is 1 on the space C0. So that tells you then that the pi 0 is surjective, namely, given any positive conformal class in the 3 sphere, there is a conformally compact Einstein metric on the 4 ball which realizes that prescribed conformal class at infinity. We already saw earlier on that if you take this topology, this again has a seed metric, the ADS-Schwarzschild metrics, but again, because we already know that pi 0 is not surjective, if you take L to be sufficiently large, you don't have any Einstein fillings, so since pi 0 is not surjective, the degree must be 0. Here's various examples of, this is just a quotient of hyperbolic space. These are certain kinds of metrics that physicists have worked with and found. And you can just quite easily then compute the degrees and see whether you have surjectivity or not. Maybe I'll just mention in closing that these techniques, these methods, have been useful for these sort of metric studies, but over the past couple of months, I've been working with some physicists in Stony Brook, where we're using these kinds of ideas to study the global behavior of renormalization group flows that come up again, sort of a different aspect of ADS-CFT. But these kinds of methods can be done also in different other settings or other aspects of ADS-CFT. Okay, thank you.